Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it is September 6th, and it's Thursday. This is going to be our last lecture on chemistry. And let's see, last time we talked about pH, and we talked about major kinds of important biological compounds in your body, and we got done talking about a couple of them. What was the first important biological compound? Carbohydrates, and you should know the general formula. You should be able to recognize what a simple sugar looks like if I give you the diagram, and probably calculate the molecular weight and things like that. We didn't go over any calculations in lecture, but those are homework assignments, and if you need help doing that, you can see me during office hours or talk to your lab instructor. And of course, you should have a non-graphing scientific calculator, just a basic calculator with you, probably at all times. All right, so and these are the elements that you have to know. Got to know how to use the periodic table. Okay, so where did we leave off? Someplace around over here. We're just talking about protein structure. All right, so proteins are the third class of compounds, and the last class we're going to look at are nucleic acids. So getting back to proteins, what's the basic building block of a protein? Yeah, amino acid. Okay, and you should understand what the amino group is, what the carboxylic acid group is. The alpha carbon on an amino acid is right here because there's a functional group attached to it, and the shape of this functional group changes depending on what the name of the amino acid is, and when the shape of this functional group changes right here, what can you tell me about the protein? Yeah, the function is going to change as a result of that. Okay. And the primary structure of a protein is just the sequence of amino acids from one end to the other. So it's like spelling a word, using letters, right, to spell a word out. Okay, I think we can go to just dual screen projection here. Right, so that's primary structure. And if we change the primary structure of this protein right here, what are we changing? We're changing the function of it, exactly right. Okay. That primary structure is going to determine how the protein can bend and coil up on itself. Some segments won't be able to form bends because the R groups prevent that from happening. And in other circumstances, that R group will allow the protein to coil in a very specific way that we call an alpha helix. All right, so it's going to look like a spiral staircase. It's going to have just that particular kind of structure to it. And so this structure right here, this is what we call secondary structure, is determined by what? What determines this secondary structure? The primary structure, that's right. If we change the primary structure, then the secondary structure of a protein is going to change. It might not be able to form this alpha helix. And a beta pleated sheet is another kind of conformation or shape that a protein can take, but it will look more like an accordion. Instead of nice sweeping arcs right here, they're going to have sharp edges and sharp bands, so it's going to have sharp edges to it. So the functions of these beta pleated sheets are going to be different than these alpha helices as well. Okay. Then, here we see a whole protein, and here is a segment of alpha helix. We see it, there are some other bends in the molecule. Okay, there's some very straight, long segments. All right, and if we look at this protein, the overall structure of it, that's what we call the tertiary structure. It's the complete bending and folding of polypeptide chains to give this particular protein its three-dimensional shape. And that's what's going to be important in this class, to understand something about its three-dimensional shape. Okay, because if we change the shape of something, what are we changing? We're going to change the function of it, that's right. So the tertiary structure is dependent on secondary structure, and I can see the secondary structure. If secondary structure couldn't form, if this alpha helix can't form in this part of the protein, then guess what? Then the tertiary structure can't form either. And, of course, then also remember that the secondary structure is determined by the primary structure, how the protein is spelled out in terms of amino acid letters. Okay. And in some places, on some proteins, there's a specific spot or a hole or a bubble that can incorporate other things into the protein. And here is a group called a heme group. This is what can bind oxygen, right? When a heme group combines with a globin protein, then it becomes hemoglobin, and then it can actually perform a function of transporting oxygen in your body. All right, so the team group is important. There's going to be an iron element in the team group that will bind oxygen and then give that oxygen up to your tissues. All right, so the things that stabilize this three-dimensional conformation, sometimes they're very strong bonds, like the bonds that make the peptide bonds within this alpha helix, but there are also associations between different parts of this protein molecule. All right, and there just might be hydrogen bonds that will bond between this part of the molecule and this one over here. And what's the strength of a hydrogen bond? It's a weak bond, right? And there's another bond that's even weaker. It's called a van der Waals forces. So hydrogen bond is due to polar interactions. Van der Waals forces are due to nonpolar interactions or between interactions between nonpolar chemicals. And those are even weaker than hydrogen bonds. And those very weak bonds determine the three-dimensional structure of this protein right here. And those very weak bonds can be broken by changing the pH of the solution, changing the hydrogen ion concentration, and also by heating proteins up past 37 degrees. Because as we increase the temperature of a solution, then molecules start to move more rapidly. They wiggle around and bend and vibrate. And as we increase the temperature, the vibration increases, and it gets to a point where all of a sudden this protein just springs out of its normal conformation and takes another shape. And when that happens, what happens to the activity of this protein? It changes as well. Okay, so denaturization is changing the conformation from its native configuration that has a particular function into another conformation, which is usually non-functional. Okay. And denaturation. Denaturation is irreversible. Once you bend a protein out of shape, then you can't ever get it back into the proper shape ever again after that. And we denature our food all the time, right, to make it more palatable to eat and easier to chew, but it's also a way of preserving food as well. But you don't necessarily have to use heat to preserve and cook food. You can cook food using acids. What's your favorite food that you cook with an acid? Ceviche, yeah, or maybe sauerbraten, or other kinds of things, okay? Or maybe you like to marinate certain kinds of things in your household, and that's partially, right, cooking the material. So here is another example of a protein, and we can see that here is an ionic bond between a carboxyl group and this amino group right here, and these two amino acids are pretty far away from each other, but it just will form this particular bend in this part of the protein, right? So that's a nice, and an ionic bond is relatively strong. All right, here's a hydrogen bond between these different groups, two different amino acids. Now this is a weak bond, so this one can be disturbed pretty easily by increasing the temperature, changing the pH. Of course, this one is going to be sensitive to pH as well. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, then this O minus is going to have a tendency to go away. When it goes away, then this ionic bond is destroyed, and then it's going to change the shape of the molecule. All right, but here are those van der Waals forces that I was talking about. These are interactions between nonpolar functional groups on distant amino acids within a protein, like these benzene rings over here and these hydrocarbon chains right here will have a tendency to interact, but these are even weaker than hydrogen bonds. So they hardly stabilize the molecule at all. Small changes in temperature and pH, right, these things will become disturbed and will produce some kind of small change in the conformation of this protein. And you know what that means. Now here is a strong interaction. This is a covalent bond. This is between two cysteine amino acid residues on this protein right here. It can form a nice covalent bond, and that securely locks this protein into position, or this bend within the protein right here. We call that a disulfide bridge or a disulfide bond. Those are difficult to break, so those are really nicely stabilizing. All right, so these are all the bonds that contribute to tertiary structure, and if we change the primary structure of this by getting rid of the cysteine amino acid right here, then the disulfide bridge can't form. And then what's going to happen to this tertiary structure? That's going to change as well, right? So if you change the primary structure, that changes the secondary, which then changes the tertiary structure, which then you can see will change the conformation and function of the protein. Okay, the denaturation with temperature and pH is going to break these different associations between different parts of the molecule. And I said it was irreversible, or at least I meant to say that. So I wanted to go back, make sure that people know that it is irreversible. Unless you have an example, I'm trying to learn of an example where it is reversible. And I know of one particular example. Right, this disulfide bridge right here is responsible for putting curls in people's hair. Some people, you know, there's millions of different kinds of hair. There's wavy hair, there's kinky hair, wavy kinky, curly wavy kinky, right? There's all kinds, and on one day it might be a different kind than another depending on humidity, which changes all of these different associations right here. But mostly the bends in people's hair is due to this disulfide bridge bond. And so you can change how your hair curls by doing what? By going to a beautician, and they know how to break this bond, and then they put your hair in a different conformation, and then they reform these disulfide bridges so that your hair then has a permanent new kind of curl to it. Okay. All right, so that's denaturing the protein because it's changing the conformation. But you know what? I learned that if you don't like what your beautician did the first time, you can go back and get it, your other hair back. They can reverse that denaturation process somehow. I'm not sure how it's done. Okay. So anyway, that's one example that breaks the rule where denaturation is irreversible. Okay. All right. And if we have, on this molecule right here, here is one protein that we saw before with a heme group in it. And if we put four of these groups together, then we can actually observe the quaternary structure of a functional protein inside your body. And this right here really is the true molecule of hemoglobin. It's four separate protein chains with four separate heme groups in there. And so a competent hemoglobin molecule can carry how many oxygen atoms or molecules? It can carry four. There's one here, one here, one here, and one here. All right, so if for some reason, if there is a change in the conformation, right, of any of these subunits right here, then these four subunits cannot join together, and then you don't have a competent hemoglobin, and then you can't carry oxygen in your body very well. And what do we call that condition when you can't carry oxygen in your body very well? Because there's a problem with hemoglobin or problem with the number of red blood cells that you're making. That's called anemia, right? So anemia, now you understand a little bit of a molecular reason of why somebody might be anemic, okay? And that's nice. Okay. Protein structure. Proteins can be modified by adding a carbohydrate to it, and then it becomes a sugar protein, but typically we call that a glycoprotein. A really good example of that would be mucus, right? That stuff that comes out of your nose when you got a cold. That's a glycoprotein. A lipoprotein is part protein and part lipid. Yeah, it's part lipid. Okay, and other protein molecules, like we saw in hemoglobin, have something that we call a pigment, and a pigment is just some kind of chemical that can absorb certain colors of light, so it has a certain kind of color appearance to it. So these chairs, what color are these chairs? Are they green or yellow, or what are they? Yellow. Okay, so they have a pigment in them that absorbs all colors of light except for yellow. And that yellow, since it doesn't absorb yellow, it reflects yellow back to your eyes, and then you see yellow when you look at that. So a pigment is just something that can absorb light energy, right, to give it a particular appearance. But of course in people, it's also used to protect your body. There's a pigment in skin, okay, and it's called melanin. So melanin is just, or a pigment is just something that absorbs energy. Okay, that takes us to our last important biological molecule, and these are nucleic acids. Examples of nucleic acids will be DNA and RNA. And just like you have to know the building blocks of a polysaccharide, what's the building block of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide, simple sugar. Yeah, what's the building block of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids and glycerol, yeah. Okay, and what's the building block of protein? Oh, you don't even have to tell me. You know that before even taking this class. But maybe you don't know what the building block of a nucleic acid is. And they are what we call nucleotides. Okay, and a nucleotide is a 5-carbon sugar right here. It's a ribose sugar or a modified ribose sugar. It has a phosphate group, an inorganic phosphate group, which is a PO4. And I think we showed you what a phosphate group looks like when we looked at phospholipids. And you're probably still amazed at that molecule here. So let's look. Continue with these nucleotides. The third thing that it has is an organic base. So here is an organic compound that likes to absorb protons from solution. That's all that means. Right? It doesn't mean that the molecule sits on this particular end. Right? It's not a structural base. It's just an organic base. And so they're joined together with nice covalent bonds. And there are in DNA. Oh, did I flip a page by accident? Oh, I did. Okay. In DNA, okay, the bases right here are guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. So there's only four. There's four bases. And so you can actually like draw a little R right here, and we can substitute different kinds of organic bases onto this position of that ribose sugar. It's a five-carbon sugar. All right, it is still a simple sugar. It's a monosaccharide, but instead of having six carbons like glucose and galactose, it has five. And on every carbon, there is what? There's a H and then a HO group. We're at a water group, so there's still carbohydrates. All right, so you can see that. Is guanine the same as thymine right here? No, because the shape is different, right? So that's how your body recognizes it, by its shape. We see that there are different colors for these things as well, but that doesn't really make too much sense, right, in the way that you should understand it. Just the shape and also the number of hydrogen bonds that this base can participate with. All right, so there is a different structural formula, okay, or presentation on each of these bases right here. So the nucleotide is the basic building block, but they can form a polymer. All right, so we can take one nucleotide and join it to another, and then join it to another, and you know what kind of reaction is used to do that. What would be used to do that? Dehydration synthesis reaction, so a water molecule is going to come out, and now you have a big long sequence of nucleotides right here. And since we see thymine is incorporated, we know that's going to be a DNA molecule in particular and not RNA. I'll describe some more rules to you. All right, so you have a long chain. This kind of reminds you of maybe like all the amino acids in a protein is just a long chain of amino acids. This DNA molecule is just going to be a long chain of nucleotides made up of these different bases right here. Okay. And in DNA, these are the four bases. And in order for DNA to form, its structure, which is going to be a nice double helix right here, we don't see a single chain, but we see a double chain of DNA. That's how DNA exists in chromosomes, as a double-stranded molecule. So anytime you see a double-stranded molecule, you're going to call that DNA. Sometimes we find a string of nucleotides as a single strand, but we don't want to call that DNA. We would call that RNA, and we'll find that out in just a little bit. All right, so how is it that thymine can bind, can base pair with adenine over here? And that's because of just their size and shape. So let's go back to this diagram right here. Okay, guanine and adenine. All right, guanine and adenine are large molecules. Cytosine and thymine are small molecules, so that when we zip together two strands, in order to base pair with a large molecule, it's got to be with a small one, and it's going to be cytosine. So the base pair rules are going to be G, C, and A is large, and T is small. They'll fit together very nicely on the inside of that helix molecule. So here is another way of observing that interaction. So we have one strand of DNA on the left, another strand of DNA on the right, and they're going to form that alpha helix. And the only way that can happen is when guanine pairs with cytosine. There's going to be three hydrogen bonds, right? And the other way that it can happen is when thymine base pairs with adenine right here. But notice the number of hydrogen bonds decreases to two. Right, and that's just because of the structure of these molecules right here. So I don't want you to know which ones are purines and pyrimidines. I don't want you to know the number of hydrogen bonds between adenine and thymine. Okay, but I do want you to know that this conformation works because of the shape of these molecules and the kinds of chemical bonds that they can form. All right, the most important thing for you to know are the base pair rules. So cytosine will always base pair with guanine. Why can't cytosine bind with thymine? yeah, the shape and size and the number of hydrogen bonds just doesn't match up. Okay, so those base pair rules, really, you cannot violate. And the other thing is, guanine can't bind with adenine because there's not enough space on the inside of the alpha helix right here to allow that to happen. So this happens, okay, based on the shape of these molecules. Okay, so the alpha helix forms due to the law of complementary base pairing, and you know the base pair rules. When I look at a DNA molecule, I see a ladder right here leaning up against the side of my house. Here is a rung of a ladder. Here are the steps of the ladder right here, so I'm just using an analogy. The handrails on the ladder are made up of what compounds? What's this one right here where I have the cursor? That's a sugar molecule. And what's this one here? Phosphate. So there is a long polymer of phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. These are put together with a dehydration synthesis reaction. And the bases are pointing to the inside of the ladder right here. So the steps are the bases that pair up, and both of the handrails is just a repeating phosphate sugar unit back and forth. Okay. There's another kind of nucleic acid, and that's called RNA. And we have some examples right here. Here we see a ribose sugar, but it's modified a little bit because in this particular position, if it was a ribose sugar, there would be an oxygen and not just a proton right here. So since this is missing the oxygen, we call this deoxyribose. That makes perfect sense. All right, so here is deoxyribose. This is the unit that is used to make DNA, and DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. That's what DNA stands for. But we could have the usual kind of ribose molecule that I see over here, and now I see a nice OH group, right? And this is what makes ribonucleic acids. This is the building block of a ribonucleic acid, or RNA. So that's really one of the big differences between DNA and RNA, is just this oxygen atom right here, right? And I think you should be impressed with that, because what kind of change is that in this ribose molecule? Do you think this is a large change or a small change? Okay. In reality, it's a large change, okay, because there's a big difference between RNA and DNA, how they behave inside your body. But to me, that's just one atom out of many, many, many. It looks like a small change to me. So small changes in shape produce large changes in function. Right? That's what I wanted to emphasize here. The only difference, another difference with an RNA molecule is that it never contains a thymine. Right, it's going to then substitute a different base that is called uracil. Right? And notice that uracil looks a lot like thymine right here, but it's different because it's missing a carbon atom over here and maybe a couple of protons. So there's a small change again in the shape of these two bases right here, and that will definitely change how they function inside the body. And the third difference between DNA and RNA is that RNA is always single-stranded. It never forms an alpha helix. And that might sort of mislead you a little bit. There might be some circumstances where things twist around in RNA. Okay, but that's a pretty good general rule to know. There are three kinds of RNA. Okay, there's messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and ribosomal RNA. From anatomy, you know what a ribosome is. A ribosome is responsible for building proteins, right, for making proteins, and a ribosome is made out of RNA as well as some protein pieces as well, some subunits of RNA, right, but a ribosomal RNA will make a ribosome. Messenger RNA is the kind of RNA that actually learns how a protein has to be spelled in order to have the correct conformation. So the primary sequence of the messenger RNA right here, which is what the kinds of nucleotides that's used to spell out how that messenger RNA is made, right, will spell out how the amino acids should be added together to make the primary structure of a protein. So the primary structure of messenger RNA determines the primary structure of a protein. And if you determine the primary structure of a protein, what does that determine? Yeah, it does. But before you get to function, what should you get to? If you determine the primary structure of a protein, what are you determining? The secondary structure. And if you determine the primary and secondary structure, what are you determining? That tertiary structure, which is the overall shape of the molecule, right? Okay, and that information is contained within the primary structure right here of messenger RNA. All right, and so in order for a ribosome to make a protein, what's the building block that it needs to make a protein? It needs amino acids. And this last kind of RNA right here, the transfer RNA, runs around in a cell, grabs a particular amino acid, brings it back to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein. That's its job. So when you see tRNA, you should say transfer RNA, but I think of it as a taxi RNA because it's just kind of shuttling amino acids around inside the cell, bringing them to... I mean, is that really the last slide? Oh, it is. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about protein synthesis in another chapter, I guess. I was getting ready to talk about protein synthesis a little bit. So, let me go back to the very first slide right here. Okay. So we're done. Atoms, chemical bonds, acid bases, pH scale, organic molecules. We talked about all these organic molecules right here. Nice. So that's it for chemistry. So I went back to the last slide. Okay, so don't forget nucleic acids. You can have two different kinds, DNA versus RNA. What are two important chemical differences, chemical conformation differences between DNA and RNA? DNA is deoxyribose. We're missing an oxygen right here. And RNA is just a standard old ribose molecule. And in DNA, we have thymine. And in RNA, we don't have thymine, we have uracil instead, but you should see that their shape is pretty much similar. Okay. All right. The other big difference between them is that DNA is double-stranded and RNA is going to be single-stranded. So if someone were to show you a nucleic acid, now you could tell, okay, from far away if it's an RNA or a DNA molecule. All right. So what I want to do right now is go back to this folder. But I might have to do something like this. See what's going on. And let's practice some of these chemical compounds. Let's see if you can recognize some of these things. Okay, and I'm on the left side, so I want to do this. This is going to work. All right, so what do we have right here? That's just a rectangle, okay? And it is a rest station. So you're not supposed to do anything on this particular slide except take a deep breath and kind of sigh and get ready for the next slide that's coming up. So let's take a look at this. What the heck is this thing? I see a base. I see a ribose sugar. And I see a phosphate group. So here is a nucleotide, but a specific kind of nucleotide. What specific kind of nucleotide? This is a ribonucleotide because of this oxygen right here. It's not the deoxyribonucleotide. So here's a ribonucleotide. So it's a building block of what? RNA. That's a building block of RNA. And you don't have, I'm not going to ask you which nucleotide it is. You don't have to recognize this one. Okay, but you should at least know that this is a ribonucleotide. All right, ready? So you get a little rest. Okay, but not for long. All right, what's this functional group right here? Sulfhydryl group. And indeed, you do have to know these things, okay, for the test. So that's why I have this as a video, I think, in Blackboard or someplace for you to look at. All right, rest station. And then we have amino group. What's your favorite molecule that has an amino group? Amino acid. Yeah, somebody said that. I like that. Okay, amino acid has an amino group in there. Here's a carboxyl group. What's your favorite molecule again for a different reason? Yeah, carboxylic acid, again, amino acid has this kind of group over here, okay? Then that allows that nice peptide bond to form when this proton or this hydroxyl group comes off of it with a dehydration synthesis reaction. And then we have a phosphate group, right? So PO4, P for phosphorus, four oxygens. These protons can come off, so this is an acidic group as well. And when we have PO4, we call that an inorganic phosphate. Sometimes we just label it P with a little I, sub I. Inorganic phosphate is PO4. And there's a molecule that has three of these things put together that you're just going to love in a little bit. Anybody know, anybody read my mind? What molecule am I thinking about that has three of these inorganic phosphates on it? It's going to be called adenosine triphosphate. Okay, tri meaning three, and that's an important energy molecule in your body. That's the energy currency inside your body. It has three of these groups, but the rest of the ATP molecule doesn't look like this hydrocarbon chain. Okay, what do we got right here? Lipid? Protein? Nucleic acid? No. Sign-in sheet. Where's the sign-in sheet at? Did I pass it around? Oh, I left it upstairs. Okay. I can maybe go get it. Maybe not. I don't know. Okay, I know where it is. All right, so here is a simple sugar, and these are what we call carbohydrates. But what's a simpler way of saying it? Carbohydrate, right? Because here you have a carbon and here's an H2O on every substitute on every carbon right here. You don't have to know if this is glucose or galactose. You should just know this is a nice simple sugar, okay, that can be used to make polysaccharides. What's this right here? Here is a carboxyl group. That means it's an acid. That's a hint. A long hydrocarbon chain, which is nonpolar. Yeah, it's a lipid, and a particular kind of lipid would be? Okay, yeah, it's a fatty acid, but even more complicated. I don't see any double bonds anywhere. All these carbons are completely saturated with protons, so this is a saturated fatty acid. Okay, saturated fatty acid. And when we bend these things around, we can make a signaling molecule out of them, like, for instance, prostaglandins. Okay. And what do we got right here? What's the reaction taking place? Dehydration synthesis reaction. And what are we building? A triglyceride. And the building blocks of a triglyceride are 1, 2, 3. Three fatty acids and glycerol. How many carbons does glycerol have? 3, which makes it kind of half of a glucose molecule. All right. What molecule is formed when we make a triglyceride? A triglyceride is formed, but what else? Since it's a dehydration synthesis reaction, you'll also make 3 water molecules as a result. What do we call the reverse of this reaction? Hydrolysis, right? So if your body wants a fatty acid, it can go to a triglyceride, hydrolyze these bonds right here, and then it's got 3 fatty acids as well as a glycerol molecule. Okay. So there's a lot you can talk about on these slides. What's this one right here? What was that? Should I go back? Okay, let's go back. What is that? CH2O. What is that? Carbohydrate. Right, and it's just a 6-carbon carbohydrate, and that's what we call a nice simple sugar. Simple sugars are the building blocks for polysaccharides, right? Okay, and if it's a 5-carbon sugar of the ribose variety, what can it be used to make? Not a polysaccharide, but a ribonucleotide, like a nucleotide to make RNA out of. Okay. Okay, what is this right here? This is what we call a micelle, but you should understand what the basic building block of this micelle is. It is a phospholipid. Here are 2 fatty acids. These are nonpolar tails. Here is the polar head group made up of, phosphate, right? Inorganic phosphate. There's also a nitrogen group in there as well. I don't think I'll ever ask you to draw that out, though. Okay, what do we got here? General class? Yeah, somebody said steroid. That's great. That's a little bit more specific. These are all steroids. And steroids belong to what class of compounds? Okay, here's cholesterol in particular. All right, so cholesterol is just one piece of these steroids right here, but all of these steroids belong to what general class of chemical compounds? Lipids, yes. All right, so these are nonpolar compounds. They like to dissolve in oil or fatty materials, like the inside of a plasma membrane, for instance, and they're also important signaling molecules. What do we got right here? Unsaturated fatty acid. There's that nice carboxyl group. Here are some double bonds, so that's a nice unsaturated fatty acid. Here is a amino acid. Let's go back and take a look at it. We have the carboxyl group, that's acidic. Here's the amino group, that's basic. And then here's that functional group that changes depending on what kind of amino acid it is on this alpha carbon right here. So amino acid has that general shape. It's a building block for proteins. What kind of bond is formed when we put amino acids together? Peptide bond, very strong bond. Okay, this one. That's got to be your favorite molecule so far. This is phospholipid, right? Because it gets along with water and it gets along with oil and it can make these fancy structures we call membranes because of it, right? So here's the glycerol molecule, three carbons. Here are the fatty acids that can combine with the carbon in the third position. Here is the phosphatidyl group that has a phosphorus and a nitrogen that makes it very polar so it can dissolve in water. So this end of the molecule can dissolve in water. This end of the water doesn't. This end of the molecule does not want to be in water. This is going to be in an oily environment, like the inside of a membrane. All right, so if the inside of a membrane is oily, is water ever found inside of a membrane? No, it's going to be excluded, right, from the inside of a membrane. All right, what are these things right here? These are modified fatty acids, and they're important signaling compounds, and we're going to call those things prostaglandins, right? So these are all different kinds of prostaglandins, and you notice a little bit of a difference in shape in these molecules. They're going to have different properties in your body because the shape of the molecule is different. Oh, what do we got right here?
Secondary structure.
Yeah, alpha helix, secondary structure. What's the building block for secondary structure?
Primary structure.
And the secondary structure right here is a building block for something else. Tertiary structure, the overall three-dimensional conformation of a protein. And then what does that determine? The function of that particular protein. Okay. All right, next one right here. What is this? Deoxyribonucleotide, right? Nucleotide is a building block of DNA or RNA. This particular one is a building block for DNA only. Okay, so this right here cannot be what base? If this is a deoxyribonucleotide for DNA, what base can this not be? Uracil, can't be uracil, right? Okay. Then rest, what do we got right here? Hydroxyl group, sure. And what molecule is this? Glycerol, okay. And what's this one here? That's a carbonyl group. Carbonyl group. Here is ribonucleotide. Okay, ribonucleotide. So are you ready now actually to take this quiz? Sort of. All right, I won't go real fast, but don't sneeze and don't blink, okay? All right, what's that? Sulfhydryl group, okay? If you didn't see it right away, you're going to have to practice online a little bit. What's that? Amino group. What's your favorite molecule that has an amino group? Amino acid. What's that? Carboxyl group. What's this? Phosphate group, inorganic phosphate. What's that? Carbohydrate, but it's a building block for something. I would like for you to say just simple sugar or monosaccharide. Monosaccharide, right? Monosaccharide. What's that? Saturated fatty acid. What's this? Yeah, triglyceride formation by what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis. What's a molecule that's made by dehydration synthesis besides that triglyceride? Water. Yeah, what's the reverse of that reaction called? Hydrolysis. Okay. How can you take a DNA molecule and break it down into nucleotides? Hydrolysis reaction, right? Or you can put nucleotides together by dehydration synthesis reaction. And if you weren't in lecture on Tuesday, then this might be a little fast for you. That's why it's so important to come to lectures every day. When you're in lecture, it doesn't seem like I'm saying anything hardly sometimes. But if you miss a day, then you realize, oh, wow, he must have said something the day before. So please try to make every lecture if possible. Okay. All right, what do we got right here? Simple sugar once again, just a six-carbon sugar, monosaccharide simple sugar. Actually, monosaccharide is what I like. Here is a micelle. You should know what the building block of a micelle is, phospholipid. Okay, and those are steroids. They belong to lipids. And here we have unsaturated fatty acid. Here we got amino acid. Here is phospholipid. And in the order of cool molecules, how would we rank a phospholipid? Like number one, okay? Okay, these are prostaglandins, and you should see they're modified fatty acids. That is alpha helix, but functionally think of maybe secondary structure, and the building block of secondary structure is primary structure, right? Okay. So you're right, that was alpha helix. So an answer on a test could be either of those, secondary structure or alpha helix. I don't know if I have both on there or not. What is that? Okay, let's go back. Okay, notice you're missing an oxygen right here. This molecule is used to make DNA. This is a deoxyribonucleotide. Okay, and I won't ask anything about that. Phosphate group. So phosphate sugar makes the handrails on a DNA molecule, and this base right here is going to be on the interior forming the steps of that molecule, right? The steps of the ladder of a DNA molecule. All right, so you get a rest right here, but not for long. What's that? Hydroxyl group. And then we've got glycerol. Then we have, that's a carbonyl group. Here is a ribonucleic acid. It's a building block for RNA. Sulfhydro group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate. Monosaccharide. Yeah, I was going to say simple sugar. Monosaccharide I like best because it makes polysaccharides. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride, yeah, by dehydration synthesis, the reverse you should know about. Okay. Monosaccharide again. All right, so I don't know if I want to go through this anymore, but I suppose if you guys ask me to do it next class or something, we can take some time to do it. But this is available for you in Blackboard. All right, so you can just play the video, and when you're playing the video, just say the name out loud before I do. So it sort of can be interactive. I won't correct you if you make a mistake because it's just a video, but you can correct yourself, right? And it's also captioned, so you learn spelling as well. Okay, you can practice spelling, and you can pause it if you want, look at spelling. And why is spelling important in here? Because it's school. That's right. Okay. All right, so let's see. I think that's good for now. Let me see what's on the schedule. Okay, so interactions between cells and their environment. So I'm going to start that one today because we've got two lectures with that one. Maybe you brought those slides in, maybe not, I'm not sure. But it's probably a good idea. So that's chapter 3. Oh, and look, I opened chapter 3 up already. Huh, how about that? Okay, so we're going to look at cell structure today and some controls on genetics. First, we're going to look at plasma membrane. That's an organelle. We're going to look at the building blocks of plasma membrane. We're going to look at some organelles, gene expression, DNA replication, and cell cycle. I might not even talk about cell cycle in here because one important component of the cell cycle is mitosis, and you already know mitosis from anatomy. But I see a question. Ah, chapter 6. Oh, look, I did skip down over here. Yeah, chapter 6. Okay. Good. I'm glad you stopped me. So, let's end the show. Yeah, let's do 6. I always like doing 6 first. Okay, so there's some more chemistry in this chapter, but it's not biochemistry necessarily. It's more like physical chemistry. Yeah. Yeah, let's get a piece of paper going and just pass it around the room. If somebody has an extra piece of paper, just put Bio 241 in the date, which is the 6th today. Yeah, and pass it around. Okay. All right, so we're going to think about different environments with inside our body. The environment inside of a cell is called the intracellular compartment. And intracellular compartment is mostly made out of water. So 67% of all the water in your body is inside of cells, right? And there's also then an extracellular compartment. There are spaces inside your body that are between the cells. We call that the extracellular compartment. So that means 33% is outside of cells. If 60% of water is inside, 33% is outside of cells. And if we think of this extracellular compartment right here, we can break it down into a couple special places, special compartments by themselves. And the first one is going to be interstitial fluid. An interstitial fluid is a space between cells. Sometimes, if it's a connective tissue, we're going to call that the matrix. Right? The matrix is always outside of cells. And the matrix can contain precipitates, protein fibers that have precipitated out of solution. Those are fibers like, anybody know the names of some fibers? Collagen is one, okay, elastic fibers, reticular fibers. Right? And then the other component of the matrix is what we call ground substance. Ground substance is a jelly-like material that one of the main functions is to hold water. But then it also allows things to move around through that water. For instance, like diffusion of important molecules is through that ground substance. That holds about 80% of the water that's in the extracellular space. And then there's another extracellular space that's not ground substance, but it is part of the matrix in a connective tissue, right? And the connective tissue is blood. And the matrix in blood is what we call what? Plasma, right? That's the fluid part. So it's kind of an interesting connective tissue because it's a fluid connective tissue. It's not a solid connective tissue like bone tissue. All right, so those are all the compartments that have water. The extracellular matrix in a connective tissue is held together by a meshwork of collagen fibers, elastic fibers, pretty much not reticular fibers, but collagen and elastic fibers, and then you have that ground substance, okay, that holds water. These fibers move through the matrix, but they also attach themselves to cell membranes through proteins that we call integrins. Right, and that just kind of anchors all of these cells together up against the connective tissue. Right, integrins are glycoproteins. Right, what does that mean? It's a modified protein. It's part sugar and part protein molecule, and they link right the connective tissue matrix to the cells that surround it. Right, so in the interstitial fluid of the extracellular fluid resides in this ground substance or that hydrated gel. Right, between different structures of your body and different cells. All right, so water is an important environment, whether it's inside of a cell as a solution or if it's in connective tissue as a ground substance. Right, your body is connected together through these watery bridges. All right, let's look at a plasma membrane. A plasma membrane is what we say is selectively permeable. It allows certain kinds of molecules to pass through it, but not all different kinds of molecules. And it all depends on the nature of the membrane. Sometimes there's a hole in the membrane, and it will allow things to pass through at one time, and then the hole closes, and then things can't pass through at another time. And then there are some molecules that can move through a cell membrane all the time. And those are going to be lipid kinds of molecules. Things that can dissolve in lipid can move through the plasma membrane, because the basic building block of a plasma membrane is the, what was the molecule that made that micelle? A phospholipid, that's right. So the interior part of a membrane is lipid in nature, is a nonpolar compound. So any kind of nonpolar compound will have the ability to diffuse through a plasma membrane. Some important molecules have transporters or channels, right? If it's a carrier-mediated transport through the membrane, then right, there's got to be a specific protein inside the membrane that allows that molecule to go through that lipid environment. So most proteins like to dissolve in water. They have polar compounds, polar residues, right? So that means that they cannot diffuse through a cell membrane because the inside of the cell membrane has a lipid nature to it, has a nonpolar nature. So polar molecules don't like to move through or can't move through cell membranes. And then there's non-carrier mediated transport. This occurs by diffusion through holes in the membrane that we call channels. Right? And sometimes these channels are open and sometimes they're closed. Another way to think about transport is by the energy requirement to move molecules across the membrane. It can either be passive or active. If it's a passive process, then compounds move down a concentration gradient, and it happens automatically. But some molecules go from a low concentration to a high concentration. It goes the opposite way. It doesn't happen automatically, and then that's going to require energy. We call that active transport. And so what there are different kinds of energy sources that can be used, but the most common one is the ATP molecule. Adenosine triphosphate is used to activate active transport mechanisms that can move compounds across the cell membrane against their concentration gradient. All right, so let's think of this car that I had when I was in college. It was really cool. I think it was a 1965 MGB. Okay, it was really old, really small, nice clutch, it was really fast, but since it was so old, sometimes the battery was dead when I get out of class, sometimes the clutch didn't work, okay, when I got out of class, there were all kinds of problems with it. So, where would I park this car so that I could get home every day? I would park it on top of a hill. That's right. And if I couldn't start the car, all I had to do is get my big toe out the door, it was so small, give a little push, and what would happen? Without the engine on, would the car roll downhill? Absolutely, right? Because here's potential energy, and that potential energy can be converted into kinetic energy, and of course I would have it in first gear with the clutch pushed in, and as I started to roll downhill, I'd pop the clutch, which would kick the engine over, and then I could drive home because it would start. Okay, so that's really nice. Then I would have the car down over here. So I would never park at the bottom of a hill because I couldn't push the car fast enough by myself to get the engine started if the battery was dead. All right, so here we have high to low down over here. In order to go up the hill, what do I need to do that? I would have to have the engine on, right? I would need energy to do that. I would have to be using gasoline. What does our body do to go uphill? It uses ATP in particular. Right, but to go downhill over here, that doesn't require ATP. This is what we call a passive process, right? So here's passive motion. Going up the hill is what? That's active. Yeah, that's active transport. All right, so the way that molecules move around inside your body is kind of similar to this diagram right here. Molecules can move from a high concentration to a low concentration by what kind of process? A passive process. But to go from a low concentration to a high concentration, it requires ATP, right? So if I walk in here right now, and nobody's had a perfume bottle open up, but if I open a perfume bottle right here, it dissolves in the air, then I have a high concentration of perfume right here, and it's zero in the back, guess what's going to happen to that perfume molecule, even though we don't have a fan on or anything in here? It's going to start to migrate by a process we call diffusion to the back of the room. Okay, and it moves because there's a concentration gradient. It's high concentration here and low in the back of the room. And if I leave that perfume bottle open all weekend and we come back on Tuesday and all the doors were closed, what can you tell me about the concentration of perfume in the room? It's going to spread out and it's going to be equal. Right? So the concentration in the front is going to be the same as in the back. And when the concentration is the same, how do those perfume molecules move then? Then they're just kind of stuck in space, right? So diffusion will stop when the concentration gradient goes away, right? So the most important thing for diffusion is the concentration gradient. In lab, you'll learn about some other things that determine the rate of diffusion, but concentration gradient is one of the most important things, all right? So passive transport goes from high to low. Active transport goes from low to high. So you should just get that right on the tip of your tongue right away, okay? High to low, low to high. That's going to be an important way to think. All right, I think we talked about what's on the slide now, what a solution is, right? A solution has two components to it. It has a solvent and a solute molecule. All right, what have you used as a solvent today? What have you used as a solvent today? Any water? Sure, that's a really good solvent for a lot of things. All right, what solutes have you used today? Maybe in combination with this solvent right here. How about what? What did you use as a solute today? Coffee, sure. When you made coffee or tea or something like that, you use water as a solvent, you put some coffee particles in it, right? I suppose you didn't have to do that. You could have gotten some coffee beans and just chewed on them or something, but usually we take those solutes, put it in a solvent, and drink it down. Okay, unless you're French, then probably you like it really kind of grainy. What's the major solvent in your body? It's water, right? We're basically dissolved in water. All the sugars and salts, amino acids are dissolved in water, right? But don't forget, water is not only the solvent in your body, but what else does it do? It participates in the biochemistry of many chemical reactions in your body. Could you name one kind of chemical reaction where water is not just the solvent, but it's a participant molecule? Cellular respiration has a lot of chemical reactions, but I'm looking for a really specific kind of name of a chemical reaction. Hydrolysis, yeah, that kind of rings a bell. What's another one? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, yeah, you guys are sort of understanding how I'm thinking a little bit. What are some important solutes in your body? Sodium, sodium ion, potassium ion. What are some that we just looked at? Chloride. Okay, I don't know if I looked at chloride recently, but anyway, yeah, chloride is a solute. But what are some other solutes that we did just get done with talking about? Amino acids, okay, fatty acids, simple sugars, those are all solutes that dissolve into the solution that makes your body up. Nucleotides, for instance, would be another example. What's a minor solvent in your body? Water is the major one, but there is a minor one. Okay, here is that phospholipid molecule, but I'm making a couple layers out of it, like this. So here is the polar head group, and then here are the nonpolar tails, sticking up like this, and this layer up over here, they're sticking down like this. And so what I've just drawn right here is the basic structure of a membrane, okay? And the basic building block of a membrane is a phospholipid, right? And this phospholipid layer right here, we're beginning to understand more and more about how important that is, okay? But since it's lipid, does water like to be in this part of the membrane? It sure doesn't, right? Because this is nonpolar. Water is a polar molecule. So here is a nonpolar environment, and nonpolar molecules can dissolve in this part of your body. Now, it's a small area compared to the rest of every part of you, but it has important regulatory functions, right? And sometimes the phospholipid molecule can be modified into an important signaling compound in your body that changes how your body functions. All right, so this area right here, this is a minor solvent inside your body. You do have a lipid solvent in your body, it's just not the major part. The major part is what? Is the water part, in the extracellular space or intracellular space. All right, we're going to talk about the lipid. So in your body you have two worlds. You got water world and you have lipid world too. Okay, we're going to talk about lipid world kind of at the end of the class. We're going to mostly talk about water world through most of the class. All right, so what can dissolve in the minor solvent? Anything that is nonpolar. Okay, cholesterol, for instance, prostaglandins, right, other kinds of compounds. All right, let's talk about diffusion for a little bit. All right, so diffusion is just the net movement from a region of high concentration to low. Is it active or passive? High to low, passive, just like my car right here. So I have a beaker with a high concentration of solute on one side, low concentration on the other. And these molecules are moving all around due to Brownian motion. And as we increase the temperature, they wiggle around even faster. They bump into each other. And if there is a pathway to get from right to left or left to right, then molecules will move from high concentration to low. And as the concentration equilibrates or become equal on either side of this partition, what happens to diffusion? It stops. It goes away. Right? So if the concentration is high, the rate of diffusion is high. As the concentration gradient starts to go away, then the rate of diffusion decreases. And then as the concentration equalizes, then diffusion stops. It doesn't mean that this molecule over here can't get to the side. Of course it can. But as this molecule moves to the right, guess what happens? Another molecule on the right moves to the left, and so there's no net diffusion. That's what we say, net diffusion. So molecules can still move back and forth, but the magnitude of these arrows is exactly the same and opposite to each other. All right, so here we have that plasma membrane that has made up of this phospholipid bilayer right here. Nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane because they can get through this nonpolar barrier. So what's another way of thinking about that barrier right there for water? I'm thinking of how can oil be used as a barrier? Oh, I know. You could take a cracker, like a wheat thin or something, okay, or Melba toast or whatever, and then put some caviar on top of it, which is a watery kind of mixture, and then a lemon slice on top of that. What's going to happen to your cracker? It's going to get really soggy, and it's not going to be nearly as much fun to eat because it won't go crunch, right? So how can you make these nice hors d'oeuvres like the day before your party and not have soggy crackers? You can have a cracker, and then just put a little butter on top of it, which is what? Oil. And then you can put any kind of water on top of that butter, and it's not going to go through that little oil layer, right? And you're going to have a nice crunchy cracker with some caviar on there and a lemon slice and have a really nice party. All right, so that water, that oily layer right here prevents water from moving through the cell membrane unless there's special channels for it, but it allows nonpolar compounds to readily diffuse through it. So nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane. Also, some molecules, small ones like CO2, and under certain circumstances, water, if there's a water channel, can move through the cell membrane. A lot of cells have special channels for water so that water can move through the cell membrane. Right? And gas exchange will occur by diffusion. So here I see an arrow, oxygen moving inside the cell right here. So what does that mean for oxygen? Where is the concentration of oxygen high? Inside your body, inside your cells, or in the atmosphere? It's in the atmosphere because it happens by a passive process. Oxygen just diffuses into your body, going from a high concentration to low concentration inside these cells. And then through cellular respiration, which produces CO2, we have CO2 leaving your body. And why is it leaving your body? Where is CO2 at a low concentration? Outside, that's right. It's high concentration inside your body, low concentration outside, so it just diffuses out, but of course your circulatory system, heart, lungs, and respiration, you know, help facilitate that process. But basically, it's just a passive process. All right, so remember, diffusion goes by just a concentration gradient from high to low. So here we have a cell membrane. We see the nice phospholipid bilayer. It's been modified because there's a protein that's been inserted into the membrane. And in this particular case right here, it forms a channel, but the channel is closed. So here are some polar molecules that are dissolved in water. They can't get through the phospholipid bilayer because here is this lipid world, right? But it could actually move through this channel if it were to open up. And there are different mechanisms that cells have to open up this channel, and it's going to allow ions or some specific ions to move right through the cell membrane. All right, and how is this ion going to move? By what kind of process? From what kind of concentration? It's high concentration over here, low concentration over here. Which way is it going to go? From the right side to the left side, or from high concentration to low? And what kind of process is that? That's a passive process. All right. So charged molecules must have an ion channel or some kind of transporter to move across the membrane. Here is just a channel. It's not necessarily a transporter. And if it's just a channel, things can only move by diffusion through this pore as it opens. Okay, that's nice diffusion. So the rate of diffusion is directly related to the most important thing right here is concentration gradient. When it goes away, diffusion stops. But if there's a membrane involved, it's also going to be determined by the permeability of the membrane to that particular compound. So in this case right here, the membrane is not permeable to the ion because the channel is closed. There won't be any diffusion. But if something tells this channel to open up, then all of a sudden this ion can move inside the cell, okay, because the membrane has become permeable to it. Temperature increases the motion of molecules, the Brownian motion, and it's like a little molecular stirring rod in solution. So as the molecules vibrate and move around more, right, then diffusion speeds up. So temperature is important. And also the surface area of the membrane is important. Surface area just means that if this is a large membrane, then there's a large doorway for things to move across it. If it's a small membrane, then if the cross-sectional area is small, then it's a small doorway for exchange across the membrane. So the rate of diffusion is what we say directly related to these concepts right here. So if we have the rate of diffusion as an equation, we would say diffusion as a rate right here is equal to a couple things. If it's directly related, where are we going to put them? In the numerator of this equation. Directly related. But there are some things that slow diffusion down. One is the size of the molecule. As the molecule gets bigger, then it's going to have a harder time moving around. Compare the acceleration of a motorcycle versus a semi-tractor truck. Okay? Motorcycle can speed through an intersection very fast. If both are at a red light, what's going to get through the intersection first? The small molecule, right? The motorcycle. All right, and a molecular weight is just a way to measure the size of a molecule. As the weight increases, the size gets bigger, the rate of diffusion decreases as well. So where would we put that? On the bottom. All right, so that we're going to call inversely related. So molecular weight would be down here, temperature, concentration, gradient, right, surface area of the membrane, permeability we would put in the numerator of this equation. All right, so next time we're going to start with osmosis, but I'll just say osmosis is just a special case of diffusion. And you could probably read about that in your text before next time. And that would be great. Pre-lecture reading assignment.